Now, as they work in the medical field with this now coronavirus, and at certain times all those who are wounded or mutilated by the Israeli aggressions, raids, whatever, we should excel, because Qasem Soleimani has set an exemplary model, a model of sacrifice for everyone who would work in every kind of field in order to excel. And I would suggest, really, we have to have this kind of Soleimani icon, like a medal for everyone who excels in his field. We should, not the Islamic Republic of Iran. We are those who benefited from his blood, from his sacrifices, more than anyone else. He embodies and dramatizes, and he gives an example about the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Republic. But we, the people of all of this axis of the resistance, people of humanity, people of goodness, should pay homage, should pay tribute to his sacrifices, and make a kind of Soleimani badge, Soleimani symbol, Soleimani icon, Soleimani honor at every level of and field of service to humanity. And this is something that should be set as an exemplary model, and everyone should sacrifice and should persist and should work with honor in order to reach this stage.
Please stay tuned. We will be seeing you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Eight-year holy defense.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we have said several times that the Iraqi dictator Saddam's main goal of initiating the eight-year war and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon the role of national cooperation and empathy during the 8 years of war, which resulted in the frustration of the enemies and victory of the Iranian people. Stay tuned, please. When the Iranian people, alongside military forces, entered the battlefield, the armed forces gained a stronger morale for fighting and repelling the aggressive enemy. The armed forces trusted the people and vice versa. This trust turned into a real belief and played a very significant role in the final triumph of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the imposed war. As the Basij volunteer forces participated in the war, people from all walks of life and from various occupations felt their responsibility to take part in the war. Most of the Basij forces were young people from different specialties. Thus, the war theater was the arena for manifestation of different talents. In view of this, from among these volunteer forces, great commanders emerged like martyr Hassan Bagheri, who had gone to the front as a journalist but turned into a genius in combat operations. Many of the scientific and technological Gordian knots of the war were opened by these very popular forces. Presently too, Iran owes many of its great achievements and progresses to these people. If we look at the war from this aspect, we should say that many of the senior commanders of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the army who played a determining role in the war were trained in the cultural ground of the Holy Defense. Although over 250,000 of the best youth of Iran were martyred in the war, the future of the country has been guaranteed by these very motivated people. The participation of Basij forces in the administration of cities and villages during the war solved many problems for the government. In fact, the Basij organization entered the arena of problems and made its utmost effort to remove obstacles on the way of government and the people. The most outstanding feature of the Basij has always been its self-sacrifice and readiness for working whenever need arises. The Basij forces didn't wait to become strong to fight. They fought to become strong. The manpower that emerged in the war firmly believed in Imam Khomeini's famous phrase, "We can." The Iranian combatants created such values during the war that have rarely been seen in the wars in the world. They would compete for doing the hardest jobs. The Basij forces, especially the youth, had fought with their carnal and mean desires first. The battlefronts were the places of self-building and moral expurgation. The combatants would never backbite or tell a lie. They refrained from having grudges against each other. They would never calumniate one another. They would avoid show-off, that is, they would do everything for God's sake and not for becoming famous or being praised by others. The higher a combatant was in military rank, the humbler he would become. In view of this, many times the commanders would wake up at night to polish the boots of their forces or wash their clothes while they were asleep. The battlefronts were the places of spirituality and hope in God. When one or some of the fellow combatants were martyred, others would try to keep the morale of the forces high and fresh. There were innumerable cultural values in the eight-year holy defense. The war caused the spirit of not fearing of death prevail among people. Many people could see manifestation of the ayahs of the Noble Quran. They could see that the blood of martyrs was enlivening, and each martyr could revive dead souls among people to continue his path. Martyrdom seeking and self-sacrifice had become the prevalent culture of the majority of the people. People highly esteemed their combatants, and martyrdom was considered as an eternal dignity. People really believed in the Quranic ayah, which reads, "And do not suppose those who have been killed in the way of Allah as dead. Rather, they are living, receiving sustenance with their Lord." According to Imam Khomeini, this ayah does not point to the life after this world, as all creatures will have some sort of life in the other world. Rather, it says that martyrs enjoy living with their Lord and enter Allah's banquet. In short, the Holy Defense was a unique period in which all divine values and moralities materialized and were palpably present in the society.
Around the World with Reporters.
Unemployment rates among Turkish youth have increased dramatically in the recent period, especially after the outbreak of the new coronavirus pandemic. According to the latest figures released by the Turkish Statistical Institute, the unemployment rate was 12.7% in September 2020. Turkish government says reviving economy is among its priorities amid the pandemic. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed not to allow foreign factors negatively affect the country's economy.
It is not possible for a state to survive in long term with rising unemployment, so we have developed various plans to revive our economy, turning it into one of the 10 largest economies in the world by equal distribution of wealth among our population.
As part of efforts to stop declining employment, the government has banned companies from firing employees during the pandemic. So it prevents us from seeing the direct effect of the coronavirus on unemployment. We cannot see it in numbers, but we can definitely see it on the ground. This is how economists explain.
Unemployment is one of the biggest economic problems in the world, and Turkey is no exception. Despite our government's projects to lower the unemployment rates, unfortunately the number are rising, especially amid the pandemic that has paralyzed the economic sector.
The government say it plans to lower the unemployment rate to 10.9% in 2023. However, it seems that it all depends on how the country plans to recover from a pandemic and the lira crisis. As observers say, the main strength point of the ruling party has been flourishing economy and low unemployment. And now, with the pandemic continuing more and more, the country is witnessing the ruling party's popularity sliding further. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Huge crowds from Damascus countryside flocked to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Held in eastern Ghouta, once a hub for terrorists, residents attended the ceremony to pay tribute as a sign of gratitude for General Soleimani's key role in defeating terror in Syria. Iran's ambassador to Syria condemned the heinous assassination crime, underlining the importance of unity of Muslims against the U.S. and Israeli plots in the region.
They assassinated General Soleimani in a coward way. The crime is against all international laws. They did that because their plans had failed in the region. The assassination only brought them shame and defeat, and will lead to their expulsion from the region.
Speakers praised the general's support to Syria as a key factor for restoring security to many parts of the Arab country.
We have gathered here to honor the memory of Commander Soleimani, who offered Syria valuable services. General Soleimani is a historic hero whose achievements changed the region.
A photograph exhibition was also organized to shed light on General Soleimani's achievements in Syria and Iraq. General Soleimani, assassinated by the U.S. a year ago in Iraq, headed Iranian military advisors in Syria at its government's request, and for years played a pivotal role in defeating terrorism and liberating many towns and villages. In Syria, the memory of General Soleimani reminds everyone of the principles of sacrifice, brotherhood, friendship, and unity. This is just one of many ceremonies held in Syria to commemorate the general and convey a message of respect and appreciation to all his achievements. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
The executive director of Yemen's petroleum company has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a over Saudi Arabia's blockade. The officials say the company lost over $100 million in 2020 due to the Saudi-led coalition violations and siege, and accused the UN of complicity.
The United Nations is providing cover for the Saudi-led coalition's acts of piracy in international waters, and it bears full responsibility for them. The violations are huge, and the fines we have suffered are immense.
The senior official said nearly two dozen petrol ships belonging to Yemen's petroleum company were confiscated by Saudi Arabia in 2020. He said the seizures came despite the fact that the ships all had transit permits from the UN. Yemen's petroleum company said the ships were released after a few months, but Saudi Arabia's quota acts of piracy cost them millions of dollars in delay fines.
The United Nations has become a clear partner in this blockade against the Yemeni people and has come to stand by the coalition of aggression, so it bears responsibility for the humanitarian crisis.
Yemeni officials say the confiscation of ships caused a spike in fuel prices and forced the closure of some services. They also say the delays and lack of fuel pushed the medical sector to collapse and caused a humanitarian crisis. Many people have to wait for days to get fuel for their vehicle and the limited number of petrol stations.
Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen has led to the deaths of Yemeni people and is pushing the country further toward what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This has taken place amid the silence of international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washalib, Sana'a.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al-Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it is leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued a policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha, that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens, who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's army kicked off a maneuver that put to test hundreds of its domestically built unmanned aerial vehicles. The two-day military exercises saw the use of a variety of surveillance and reconnaissance drones, combat drones, bombers, and loitering munitions, which are known as suicide drones. As part of the drill, the Persian Gulf was simulated as the conflict zone, where the Iranian Army's Navy used the suicide drones to destroy their targets.
All of the four forces of the army took part in the drills by deploying their drones. Each force concentrated on their assigned missions. We at the Navy used a variety of our stealth drones that can fly deep into the enemy's waters and keep a close eye on their activities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's defense industry has been hit by U.S. arms embargoes for four decades. The sanctions have barred Iran from purchasing any foreign weapons, even from its closest allies. However, Iranian officials say the country's defense sector is up and running. The reason is the country has for all these years been developing its own arms based on domestic capabilities. And now drones are the epitome of Iran's advances in the defense industry.
In the field of UAVs, Iran is neck and neck with the few countries that have the technology. We began by producing surveillance UAVs, but today our unmanned aircraft can conduct combat missions as well. And we owe this achievement to US sanctions, because they forced us to rely on our domestic resources.
The Islamic Republic stepped into the field of UAV production around 2011 by reverse engineering American and Israeli drones it electronically commandeered or shot down. Tehran says today it is self-sufficient in designing, producing, and operating a range of UAVs with different applications.
In less than a decade, the term UAV grew from an alien word to a keyword in Iran's airspace. Still, the Iranian army says this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the greater part of Iran's defense capabilities is yet to be publicized.
The Prime Minister made the announcement Monday. The country will be going back to its 2020 mantra: stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. Boris Johnson warned there were going to be tough weeks ahead, but still offered a ray of hope.
The weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. But I really do believe that we're entering the last phase of the struggle, because with every jab that goes into our arms, we are tilting the odds against COVID and in favour of the British people. And thanks to the miracle of science, not only is the end in sight, but we know exactly how we will get there.
Some children across England had one day in school before the announcement was made, and people are vexed by yet another last-minute announcement. The opposition says the government is going to make mistakes, but to make the same mistakes again is unacceptable. But Boris Johnson insists the tier system was working and that the new variant of COVID-19 is what derailed it. The Prime Minister's remarks caused hashtags resign, school closures, and Boris has failed the UK to shoot to the top of the country's Twitter trending charts. He is accused of ignoring the science by insisting schools are safe. The third lockdown will be hard for families juggling work and school, but many companies in the leisure, retail and hospitality sectors feel they might not make it through to the spring. In response to these fears, the Chancellor of the Exchequer made an announcement Tuesday.
Well, in order to help support businesses through a difficult period through to the spring, today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help. For businesses in the most affected sectors who are asked to close, they will receive up to £9,000 in a one-off cash grant. It's important to remember that comes on top of the existing monthly grant of £3,000 that those businesses receive and the extension of furlough all the way through to April. You know, we remain committed to protecting jobs and supporting businesses.
The new COVID-19 restrictions come days after the UK and the EU reached a trade and security agreement as part of their Brexit divorce deal, and businesses in Britain had to start trading differently. They were dreading this, but now they say planning around COVID-19 restrictions has made the extra paperwork surrounding post-Brexit trade pale into insignificance. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Christmas holidays are almost over in Italy. It's been a particularly testing time for many as the country is struggling to recover from the economic slowdown caused by the coronavirus pandemic. A study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that about 4 million Italians have been seeking help, many for the first time, to put food on the table during these Christmas festivities. The association has warned the number of people needing food support has doubled compared to last year.
These figures give a snapshot of what the current economic situation is in Italy. 4 million people had to resort to soup kitchens or food pantries this Christmas due to the anti-COVID restrictions. The situation is rapidly aggravating, with our estimates indicating that this year many more will join the ranks of the poor.
About one-third of all people seeking help in Italy during the pandemic are first-time recipients, charitable groups have warned. In a reversal of usual trends, most are Italians and not foreign residents.
According to Coldiretti, among the new poor in Italy, there are those who have lost their jobs, small traders or artisans who were forced to shut down, people employed in the underground economy who do not enjoy special subsidies or public aid and have no savings or assets to fall back on.
The economic crisis caused by the pandemic is wreaking havoc, especially among the middle classes. We weren't expecting this to happen so quickly.
Some have lost their job. Some others work much less compared to pre-COVID times. Some friends of mine couldn't buy presents. Some had to give up many other things. It's really hard for an increasing number of people.
The government is reportedly looking at extending the current restrictions until January 15, meaning that non-essential shops will be closed and bars and restaurants can only do takeaway services during weekends. A major question is whether Italy's high schools will reopen as planned on January 7. Max Civili, Rome.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived, when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian. Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
The situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US and internationally, because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, or the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Kibela, London.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria held a ceremony attended by many of its members to commemorate General Qasem Soleimani. The theme of the event echoed the organization's earlier statement that the world cannot forget the martyrdom of the Iranian general. The Islamic movement described the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as a war crime, adding that those who carried out the murder must be held to account.
Is very important as an international figure who was able to stop the capture of Syria from the forces of ISIS and Daesh. He was also able to empower the Islamic resistance, the Palestinian Islamic resistance against the Israel. He is also able to stop the advancement of ISIS in Iraq.
Various speakers at the lecture described late General Soleimani as a strong defender of the Palestinian resistance who took a stand against Zionist occupation forces. They said General Soleimani played an important role in the liberation of the Syrian city of Aleppo and eliminating Daesh terrorists. The speakers described General Soleimani as a champion of interreligious harmony who will be missed.
We feel that we are together with the principles on which General Qasem Soleimani died. And that is the principle of justice, the principle of preventing, trying to establish justice on the face of the earth, and also the principle of trying to prevent oppression and tyranny.
The lecturer said the martyrdom of General Soleimani and his ally, deputy head of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has added a glorious chapter in the history of self-sacrifice. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said General Qasem Soleimani was a man of God and a hero of Islam who succeeded in confronting and defeating enemies of Islam. They said Qasem Soleimani contributed in saving millions of innocent lives and protecting the holy shrines, thereby bringing honor, dignity, and pride to the Muslim Ummah. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kano.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 26 of Surah Jathiyah.
قل الله يحييكم ثم يميتكم ثم يجمعكم إلى يوم القيامة لا ريب فيه ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون.
Say, O Prophet, it is Allah who gives you life, then He makes you die. Then He will gather you on the day of resurrection in which there is no doubt, but most people do not know. If you remember, in our last Friday's episode of this series, while explaining the previous ayahs of this surah, we said that blind pursuit of materialistic life with immersion in sins deprives a person of faith in God and thereby denial of the hereafter. This means there is no logical argument for the disbeliever's refusal to believe in resurrection, and it is the height of absurdity for them to demand that their dead are immediately brought back to life. The ayah that we recited to you now commands the Prophet to explain to the disbelievers that the Almighty Creator brought you into existence and will make you die. Then, even though your corpses have decayed, become rotten bones and powered into dust, He will raise you to life in your original shape and size on the day of resurrection, of which there is no doubt. It is strange that you seem to be ignorant of these undeniable facts of the system of creation, which follows an order through the will of the all-wise Creator. In other words, the evidence of divine omnipotence, wisdom, and justice is so clear that there is no room for any doubt or denial regarding resurrection. In other words, if you contemplate and properly use your God-given intellect, you will be able to recognize the order, harmony, and purpose of creation and become capable of perceiving the qualities of life, death, resurrection, and judgment. To be more precise, this worldly death is a preamble to everlasting life, since the purpose of the end of mundane life is prelude to immortality for all human beings, with the believers enjoying the perpetual bliss of paradise and the disbelievers the ceaseless torment of the fires of hell. Otherwise, the creation of the world would seem to be vain. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, life itself is the reason for certainty of the next life or resurrection for the day of judgment. And number two, disbelief is the result of the failure of a person to use the gift of intellect to properly contemplate on the manifest signs of God in the world of creation as well as in one's own self. Now let us listen to ayah 27 of the same surah.
وَلِلَّهِ مُلْكُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَيَوْمَ تَقُومُ السَّاعَةُ يَوْمَئِذٍ يَخْسَرُ الْمُبْطِلُونَ.
To Allah belongs the kingdom of the heavens and the earth. And when the hur sets in, the falsifiers will be losers in that day. This ayah tells the deniers of the day of resurrection and judgment to ponder on the power of the Almighty Creator in the heavens and the earth in order to understand that He can revive them, since all existence is in His power. It warns mankind against denying truth and following falsehood so that they would not be the ultimate losers on the arrival of the day of resurrection. This means worldly losses are trivial, but the losses to be incurred on the day of resurrection shall be catastrophic. In other words, on the day of resurrection, the disbelievers and evildoers shall be the permanent losers, since they had spent their life in vanity and ignorance despite the ample opportunities provided to them by the all-merciful Lord to repent and reform. In other words, the mortal world of the transient world resembles a marketplace where people are supposed to accrue the gains of the hereafter, which are spiritual and necessary for everlasting life that follows. Failure to accrue gains despite the availability of the capital of life may be likened to a bankrupt merchant having lost his capital without accruing any gain from worldly life. There will be nothing in store for such persons except rue and regret on the day of resurrection. From this ayah, we learn the following points. Number one, the Almighty Creator is capable of recreating in their original form all things that have decayed and perished, including human beings. Number two, by contemplating on the wonders of the world of creation, one can discover the absolute truth about God and His blessings to all. And number three, resurrection is necessary for the final judgment to determine the purpose, the creation, by rewarding the righteous and punishing the evildoers. Now let us listen to ayahs 28 and 29 of Surah Jasiyah.
وَتَرَى كُلَّ أُمَّةٍ جَاثِيَةٍ كل أمة تدعى إلى كتابها اليوم تجزون ما كنتم تعملون هذا كتاب لا ينطق عليكم بالحق إنا كنا نستنسخ ما كنتم تعملون
And you will see every nation fallen on its knees. Every nation will be summoned to its book of record of deeds. Today you will be requited for what you used to do. This is our book, which speaks truly against you. Indeed, we used to record what you used to do. On the day of resurrection, everyone shall kneel down in fear and anxiety, since the system of creation is kept in order and harmony, and the records of human deeds are based on manifest evidence. When the record of deeds is opened, everyone will be called to account on the basis of their deeds, and everyone shall be recompensed according to their deeds. It may also mean that the nations of the past will be judged by the heavenly scriptures revealed to their respective prophets and whether or not they acted upon its instructions. The word Jathia mentioned in Ayah 28 means kneeling down at the time of fear, awe, anxiety, humility, and submission. Since the record of deeds of each and every one will be open for the final judgment. As specified by Ayah 29, the book mentioned here is the record kept for everyone to detail their deeds, which means all nations have one single book in which everything and deeds of everyone are registered in it. The all-merciful Creator will tell people that their book is before him, and it testifies to whoever has been done by each and every human being. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, the system of creation is based on truth and justice, and the minutest acts of every single person are recorded in detail. And number two, the reward or punishment on the day of judgment is based on deeds done during mortal life, whether good or evil. Now let us listen to ayahs 30 and 31 of this surah.
فأما الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات فيدخلهم ربهم في رحمته ذلك هو الفوز المبين وأما الذين كفروا أفلم تكن آياتي تتلى عليكم فاستكبرتم وكنتم قوما مجرمين
As for those who have faith and do righteous deeds, their Lord will admit them into His mercy. That is the manifest success. But as for the faithless, they will be asked, Were not my signs recited to you? But you were disdainful, and you were a guilty lot. On the day of judgment, people will be divided in two groups for receiving either reward or punishment. The true believers will be showered with divine mercy and grace. And this is indeed the manifest success or fawzun mubin, as the Arabic phrase says. Of course, the firm faith of the true believers ought to be accompanied with righteous deeds to deserve the highest degrees of divine mercy and rewards. Although the all-merciful Lord forgives the faults and sins of those who had repented and reformed themselves before death. As for the faithless, that is the disbelievers who had denied the teachings of the prophets and refused to submit to the one and only creator of the universe by indulging in polytheism, idol worship, atheism, and even distortion of the message of the heavenly scriptures in order to follow their vain desires and mislead others, they will be deprived of divine mercy. Sins stem from disbelief and arrogance. Thus, Ayah 31, following the previous ayah's expression of the sublime station of the believers and the virtuous persons, reproaches the disbelievers. It means to say, were not divine ayahs recited to you for your guidance by the prophets, the imams, the saints, the scholars, and the righteous persons? The torment and punishment in which you are engulfed now is the result of your own evil, since you were disdainful of the words of guidance and ended up as the guilty lot. From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one, true belief and righteous deeds are inseparable and lead towards perpetual bliss and salvation. Number two, disbelief and sins originate from arrogance and self-conceit. And number three, the all-merciful Lord never wrongs anyone, and it is only the sinners and disbelievers who wrong themselves by indulging in evil despite the ample opportunities for repentance provided by God.
The White House in transition released two New Year statements. While outgoing President Trump reflected on what he called his historic victories, President-elect Biden looked to the future with plans for improvements such as distributing COVID vaccines more quickly. In working our way back to review Iran in 2020, America's historic victories come into play. Trump's accomplishments included frequently ignoring the severity of the pandemic and at times even ignoring the science behind virus transmission. Earlier in 2020, he presented Iran with a New Year gift, the lifeless body of its anti-Daesh general, Soleimani. Soleimani was assassinated on the 3rd of January by a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad. And later in the year, towards the year-end, Fakhrizadeh, an Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today and running you through the year past. In between assassinations, Iran grappled and is still grappling with the coronavirus like the rest of the world. But whilst under the harshest ever sanctions imposed by the US. In attempting a chronological account of events, I begin with cause of the year's first assassination. Dr. Marandi is going to be accompanying us on this show. And you'll be seeing some of our show guests from past and reviewing 2020.
I think the reasons for the murder of General Soleimani are quite obvious. The Americans were frustrated that they were defeated in Syria. They were supporting ISIS and al-Qaeda, and so were their allies. And they were hoping to undermine Syria. We know that from the former U.S. Secretary of State, Kerry, when he said we allowed ISIS to advance on Damascus to put pressure on President Assad.
Soleimani was martyred after Trump was impeached, but before his Senate trial. So it was partly a distraction from White House insufficiency and offense. Trump simply mulled over the decision over a round of golf, according to Bob Woodward, the journalist who authored Rage, a book on President Trump.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
This was at a 9th January news conference, a day after the Iranian reaction to the assassination. But how realistic was Trump's explanation? No sooner had he spoken than his own Secretary of State Pompeo contradicted him, saying there were a series of imminent attacks that were being plotted by Qasem Soleimani. We don't know precisely when, and we don't know precisely where. Apparently, that speculation was enough to slay the father and protector against Daesh or ISIS, along with his company of nine, including a man who enjoyed similar reverence in Iraq, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. That was the deputy commander of the Hashd-al-Shaabi paramilitary umbrella group.
So then we saw the Iraqi parliament move to expel, to call on the United States to leave and end the occupation. And we saw the millions of people in Baghdad go to the streets demanding for the end of the U.S. occupation. And during the anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, again we saw huge crowds in Baghdad on the night of the terror attack, as well as during the following day. So the response of the Iraqi people was very different from what we would be hearing from Western and pro-Western media outlets and think tanks and pundits.
Soleimani wasn't exactly your run-of-the-mill IRGC commander. He had evolved socially as well as militarily, so it wasn't completely surprising to see women with partially covered hair among the millions of mourners, or for me to see a policeman quietly weeping as he kept an eye on the procession from above, on the pedestrian bridge where we were filming. Soleimani volunteered for the eight-year war of the 80s that Iraq imposed on Iran with generous help and encouragement from world powers. Over the U.S. strike on the Soleimani al-Muhandis Company, Iraq could not remain quiet either. And in the face of growing anger, the Iraqi parliament urged the government to oust the roughly 5,200 American troops stationed in Iraq.
Based on conventions, when a country has military barracks in another country, even legally, but carries out military action in violation of their agreement, the latter's military presence will be deemed illegitimate. Then, the host nation can reverse the agreement and demand that they withdraw their troops. The U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq violated international conventions as well as bilateral agreements. What the U.S. did amounted to human rights violation.
As for the Iranian reaction to the U.S. strike, ballistic missiles fired at Iraq's Ain al-Assad base where U.S. forces were stationed. America's inability to defend itself against the air attack or its unpreparedness was a great historical humiliation for that superpower that has made West Asia its business more than that of West Asian states themselves.
After the assassination of General Soleimani, the Americans sent us messages through diplomatic channels and we responded to them. They also sent mediators who were making efforts so that the Americans decide the timing and the place of retaliation. One of these mediators said that President Trump was even ready to lift sanctions on Iran in return for no retaliation from Tehran.
The Americans had no ballistic missile interceptors in range when on January the 8th, Iran fired 13 ballistic missiles into Iraq at bases housing American troops, 11 of which hit the Ain al-Assad base. It was a warning, and no American or coalition partners were killed.